George, are you there?
Hey, yes, John, hi.
How are ya?
Good, good. It's starting to get chilly here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, it's a very cold fall day. One of the first classic fall days we've had in a very weird fall.
Yeah, it's been warmer here than usual. We've been getting into the 60s and low 70s sometimes, but freezing at night.
Yeah.
Oh, we had. But now it's nice and crisp, like I like it.
We still had peepers peeping at night just until a couple of weeks ago.
Wow, those are those little frogs?
Yes, little frogs, and also various insects still making their noises, which, you know, normally that stops in mid-September or so.
Wow. Yeah, and here I noticed that the cottonwood trees along the Santa Fe River, a lot of them still have their yellow leaves, and it seems late to me, but I don't know, maybe there's something to this global warming.
Well, I'll have to ask Andy Repkin the next time I see him.
Yeah, we should get him back.
We should.
He's doing a new blog. Did you see that? It's called, what is it, Earth dot, no, something, is it something dot Earth? Or maybe just dot Earth.
Dot Earth, that sounds right.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I should have him back on because there's a lot going on in that realm, and you know, we've got this Green Book Award that I created at Stevens, and we've got to up with a book to give it to for next year.
Oh, what's the deadline?
It's whenever I decide.
Oh, that's good. I'll see what I can come up
okay.
with.
Okay, we've got a few candidates already. Anyway, we could talk about that some other time. You know, there's something else that happened at Stevens I wanted to mention quickly before we get to science in the news. I sort of feel like in the new and improved Blogging Heads, they want us to cover breaking news events instead of
I hope not.
Anything that we feel like talking about.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe, but everyone's doing that. But anyway, there's some good science news this week and last, but what happened to Stevens?
Well, so we have this lecture series, and on Wednesday night we had a lecture by a woman named Janet Conant.
Oh yeah.
Who is actually, she was a classmate of mine at Columbia Journalism School back in '82 and
'83. Oh.
And she's gone on to have a really interesting career. She was at Newsweek for a while as a sci-tech writer, then was at Vanity Fair. And then she wrote a couple of histories of research during World War II, which were inspired by her own recollections of growing up as the granddaughter of James Conant.
Bryant Conant?
Yes, who was the president of Harvard during World War II. And I hadn't realized, I'm sorry to say, I didn't read Conant's books before before she came, but during her lecture, she said that her grandfather actually was one of the original creators of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that either.
Yeah, so he and the president of MIT, I forget his name, in the early 40s, they were having such success with this radar lab that had been created for military research at MIT that they decided to create a similar big project with lots of brilliant scientists and lots of money devoted to creating an atomic weapon, which was seen as a real long shot. But,
you usually hear just the story about Leo Szilard, the Hungarian physicist, urging Einstein to write a letter to Roosevelt,
they were known as scientists, especially Einstein, but they still needed these politically connected figures to take up their cause, and Conant was probably the most important person to do that. So he was the one that convinced Roosevelt at the time and Congress that this was a worthwhile endeavor, especially because it seemed as though the Germans were doing research themselves.
So you think really had more influence probably than Einstein, who they may have just dismissed as
a wacky,
you know, unified field theorist.
Right.
And, you know, that weird relativity stuff.
And
then you get the president of Harvard, you know, from, I don't know if he was from a Boston Brahmin Society or...
I think
but anyway,
he was.
Influential.
Yeah, and he was the person who picked Oppenheimer to be the chief science officer of the whole project.
Huh, no, I didn't.
And then Oppenheimer, as you probably know, he was the one who decided to base the laboratory in Los Alamos.
So, yeah, right.
So Conan was going over all this material, and then it really got interesting and kind of emotionally fraught at the end of her talk, where she discussed the actual bombing of Hiroshima. It was Conant, she said, who actually picked Hiroshima as the primary target or test bed for an atomic attack by the Americans.
Wow.
And afterwards, and in her talk, she defended his decision passionately. So there are some people who have said we didn't need to actually drop the bomb on a populated area. We could have had a demonstration out in the ocean or something like that, and the Japanese would have surrendered. And she said that the Japanese had been fighting so ferociously in Iwo Jima and Okinawa and all these islands that they were defending as they sort of retreated back to their country, that the expectation was that an invasion would be defended ferociously and to the last man, possibly, and at cost of many, many Allied casualties.
Right. Yeah.
So she was saying...
So it was supposedly better to vaporize all these innocent Japanese civilians.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know people make compelling, strong arguments for that, and I've never been able to... I don't know, they don't sway me, but, you know, we weren't there then. We don't know, the context was so different, but my God.
What a decision to make.
Yeah, and then to, you know, live with it. And
well, she said that he didn't regret that decision, and, you know, it was to a great extent his decision.
Yeah.
But he did regret dropping the bomb on Nagasaki. He thought that was unnecessary. I'm not sure how much he publicly, or if he ever publicly protested that. He became, what Conan said that also I hadn't realized was that right after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was this huge upswelling of support for what had been done, and the scientists were lionized and hailed as heroes. But then after a few weeks, when the international press started writing about what had happened in these cities, and pictures were published of charred babies and people with their skin peeling off, and
their
of course
eyes melted.
Then there was this wave of revulsion, even in the United States, for what had been done. And Conant was the point man for the administration in defending the decision. So even if he had qualms, and Conan said he was really haunted by the rest of his life by these decisions, he had to defend them. I mean, that was sort of his official capacity.
Yeah.
And there was a pretty intense discussion at my school. There were a couple of people in the audience who were bringing up data that they thought, historical data that suggested that we did not have to drop the bomb on populated areas.
Mm-hmm.
And Conant was defending that, defending her grandfather's decisions very vigorously. So it was.
Yeah. God, that must have been. I wish I were there. I'm going to read her books now.
You should. Well, because especially the most. So she's written two books, Tuxedo Park.
Yeah. That was kind of about like some early secret government research lab, right? In Tuxedo Park, New York. That sounds fascinating.
Set up by a financier named Henry Loomis.
Yeah.
Who was sort of a science hobbyist, and then he created a private lab up in Tuxedo Park, and that became the radiation lab, or the radar lab.
Oh, that was the original rad lab.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
That became the big lab at MIT, but her next book, it's called 109 Palace.
East Palace,
yes.
Yeah. You know, that's just, you know, a mile from my house.
Well, see, that's why I thought you might find it interesting. It's all about the founding of Los Alamos and...
Yeah, 109 East Palace was the Manhattan Project's office in Santa Fe, and it's really great block downtown where it's, the whole complex is called Sena Plaza, or I guess this was, I'm not sure if it's part of Sena Plaza or right next to it. It all is kind of a continuous old hacienda-style building, and the scientists, when they arrived, they'd arrive in Laney on the train, which is the nearest train stop, and then they'd be driven to 109 East Palace and get their papers and their secret identities and things.
And then go trooping off into the this really awful camp up in the mountains in Los Alamos.
Yeah, I guess it was pretty rustic conditions, especially if you weren't one of the top people.
Right.
Yeah, but I love the history is just fascinating. When you go up to Los Alamos, they have two museums. One is more of a science museum, and it's good, but what's really great is an old museum on the history of the Manhattan Project with these old photographs. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was looking, 109 East Palace is now something called Onorato Home and Ambiance. Since 1987, the specialty here has been luxury European bedding and bath products.
Uh-huh. I guess that's progress.
You know, between here and 109 East Palace, here being where I live, there's also the Delgado Street Bridge, which was the handoff place for, I guess it was it Klaus Fuchs?
And, yeah,
and it was
the
David
spy.
Greenglass? David, yeah.
Oh, there was more than one spy?
Well, of course there were the Rosenbergs and Klaus Fuchs and David, was it Greenglass?
He was the person that Fuchs passed his secrets to?
Oh, God, I don't remember. I should look these things up before.
It's interesting. You know, another thing that Conan said that was getting people riled up was that, first of all, she thought that this is an important piece of history for everybody to be familiar with, but especially scientists, because we're at war now, not just in Iraq, but there's this war on terror. You know that many scientists are involved in creating technologies that can be used for national security purposes. At my own school, there is a lot of research on encryption and surveillance technologies and all these sorts of information technologies that can be used for national security purposes. And she said that scientists should be, they can't just see themselves as scientists. They have to think through the ethical implications of what they're doing. And she actually said, who are the scientists who are speaking out about how their research is being used by the military now? And nobody could think of any, and I couldn't think of any, but actually since then I've thought of anthropologists who have been enlisted by the Pentagon to give them advice on how to handle tribal rivalries in Afghanistan and Iraq, for example. And actually there are some leading anthropologists who are speaking out against that alliance of anthropology with the military, even though some anthropologists who are doing it have convinced themselves that it's a good thing and it will help people in Iraq and Afghanistan. But there's some others who think that that's just an unholy partnership of science and the military.
Well, it was a huge issue when we were in college with Vietnam and all the the DARPA sponsored research on some of which was only had really tangential applications. Like a lot of the most of the artificial intelligence research was really funded by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, but not, as I understand it, with any, with hopes of having necessarily immediate applications.
Yeah.
You know, like killer robots and things like this, but more just, this very idealized idea of defense, that a very important part of a country's defense is to be doing the best, most cutting-edge science in all different avenues.
So I guess it would include economic strength under national security.
But then obviously, the closer you get to where you're actually producing something. Well, we got into this when we were talking about the Jasons.
Well, anyway, Yeah,
wow, that sounds amazing. I was just looking it up, just for the record, and Delgado Street Bridge was indeed Klaus Fuchs.
Uh-huh.
And the other spy was David Greenglass. And I'm not sure if he was involved in the bridge incident or not. I'll have to go back and look at Richard Rhodes' great book, you know, The Making of the Atomic Bomb.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff about Conant must be in there. I just have forgotten it.
Yeah, well, it was news to me.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So
back to the front pages of the papers and...
Yeah,
and,
the State of the Universe report.
Yeah, breaking science news. So the story that I noticed this week was by Gina Colata, a front page story on cloning monkeys.
Yeah, they cloned... So what's the deal? They cloned a monkey cell and used it to get stem cells that were genetically identical to the... to the monkey, obviously.
Yeah, I think they actually created... There was an extra step. They created embryos from skin cells of an adult monkey, and then from those embryos, they extracted stem cells.
Yeah. Sure, because then you could get stem cells for all kinds of different lines.
Yeah, and this has been... I mean, everybody was expecting this to happen sooner or later. I think this was a claim... that had been made. Actually, it was some South Korean.
Oh yeah,
scientist.
This is what the he's the one who said he did it with humans.
Yes,
right?
Like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And Hwang was his name.
Yeah, I God, that was such an embarrassing.
And it turned out that was a fraud, and that had been splashed over the front pages of papers around the world.
Yeah, it was a huge story.
Yeah, and it had originally been published in Science, I think, so peer reviewed. That was a tremendous. A tremendous embarrassment, but this looks like the real thing, and if it can be done with monkeys, at least according to this story that Gina Colata did, it should be relatively easy to take the next step and do it with humans. And so then
I can't see why it wouldn't just be, you know, why it would be any more difficult, except politically.
Yeah, I thought that that it was sort of primates as a class that were considered to be more difficult than, for
than
example,
the mice. And,
mice or sheep. Remember Dolly the sheep,
right?
And some other animals. I wasn't really sure why primates were supposed to be.
Yeah,
so difficult.
Yeah, I'm not sure why either. But once you get one primate, I mean, you know, there was this guy Darwin that argued that we're related to these big monkeys and apes and things. So if he's right, if he's right, this will. This will be huge.
Well, so what do you think? So then, you know, in this story, there was the obligatory quote from the bioethicist who was warning that this could take us down this dark and dangerous path toward...
the slippery slope.
Cloning humans.
Yeah, Nazi monster scientists. Creating humans in laboratories. And I don't know. I really find that really hard to worry about, you know, when you think of all the, you know, the potential for medical therapies that could come out of stem cell therapy.
Well, what's your attitude about cloning itself, cloning humans? I mean, I never really understood what the big deal is.
Yeah.
Why do you think people find it so horrible? And it seems to be, I mean, even the scientists, when they're defending cloning and stem cell research and all this sort of stuff, usually just sort of defend the medical benefits, and they say, of course, we're not going to actually clone humans.
Yeah, right. But if they really want to, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's creepy to think of, coming face to face with someone who had your exact genetic complement. It's sort of like, you know, there's that movie that just came out, a computer animation where they scanned in Angelina Jolie and all these people, so they look almost human-like, and yet there was an interesting blog thing on the New York Times Bits blog about this, and they talked about just kind of this eerie feeling of what it would be like to look at this person, you know, this simulated person who's almost human but not quite human, and it would maybe be similar if you came face to face with your own clone.
Well, you know, what puzzles me about this is that we've always had natural clones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, from the beginning of time, we've had identical twins. And so when people say how, weird it is that we have genetically identical copies of a human. I would think the identical twins would find that insulting.
The fact is once once the embryo splits into two genetically identical identical progeny, then within seconds they start diverging along different paths.
So the scenario that I like to pose to people is, let's say you've got a couple who they have a child the old-fashioned way, and then something happens to the child, and the couple is distraught, and they decide that they want to clone it. What's wrong with that? Why should the state intervene to prohibit them from doing that?
No, I don't think they should. I mean, I think it's kind of an odd thing to do, rather than just having another child. But what the hell? Why not?
It'd
be very interesting because they'd find that the same, the same combination of genes growing up in basically the same environment but on a different timeline a little later is going to become a completely different person.
By the way, I just have to tell you a bizarre incident that happened to me once related to this debate about cloning. I once was at a dinner party with all these bioethicists.
You're right. You're near the hotbed, right?
The Hastings Institute. And so we were talking about cloning and stem cells and everything. And I posed this question: what's wrong with a couple who's lost their child from cloning it? The child has been killed. The couple decides to clone it. What's wrong with that? And I posed it to this particular bioethicist who's very prominent, sitting across the table from me, and he was sitting right next to his wife, and they both visibly blanched and were kind of looking down at their plates, and at that moment I remembered that their daughter had been murdered. So then I was probably blanching myself, and I was trying to figure out what to do next. Fortunately, this ethicist kind of composed himself and said, even in that situation, I think that would be wrong. They would be trying to recreate that child, and that's impossible. He sort of presented the standard argument against cloning. It's saying each individual is separate. And sort of then the argument continued. And I actually apologized.